What is public art? Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a good weekend. And just ahead this Monday, it's Public Art Week in Jacksonville. A closer look at what actually constitutes public art and why it's sometimes controversial. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, how to treat your vertigo, a special seminar this week here at WJCT. Plus Cole Pepper with a recap of the U.S. Open. That's later. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, controversy over what is considered public art, just as the city of Jacksonville marks Public Art Week. Now, there are a number of events this week to celebrate the importance of public art in this city. At the same time, activists have been chided by the city for putting stickers bearing the face of abolitionist Harriet Tubman in public places around town. The city also voted down a proposal to place a lynching memorial in Heming Park. In the past, artists have run afoul of the city in other ways for creating public art in Duval that wasn't officially sanctioned by authorities. So we're beginning the hour with a closer look at Public Art Week as we welcome artist Tracy Thornton with the Cultural Council of Greater Jack's Art in Public Places Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Shawana Brooks is here, arts and culture developer with the Jack's Main Library.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hope McMath, founder and director at Yellow House.
Good morning.
And by phone, Bill Delaney of the Jackson, WJCT's joint multimedia project with Modern Cities. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning.
And we're talking about Public Art Week in Jacksonville, all of the reasons why public art is important and why it sometimes gets controversial. Give us a call. What do you love about public art? Has there been public art you've objected to? Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open as well. All right, Tracy Thornton, let's begin with you.
Yes.
You're on the Art in Public Places Committee. This is Public Art Week in Jacksonville. Let's talk about why this is happening, first of all.
Well, let me just clarify. I'm an artist first. I'm not necessarily here as a representative of Cultural Council because they're all staff. As a member of the Art in Public Places Committee, I am a volunteer. So I'm still very much entitled to my autonomous autonomous views and perspectives as far as public art's concerned. So what else would you like for me to say about public art? What else would you like to know?
Well, let's talk about the importance of this week, first of all. Why is it important to you and to the community?
Well, first of all, I think a lot of the time people walk past art on the streets and they don't necessarily think about what would happen if it wasn't there. How would my life be different? A lot of the work that I do, in addition to art in public places, is about being an advocate for the arts all over town. A lot of the time here in Jacksonville, art is seen as more of an elitist activity. It's something that you do when you're in Riverside. It's something that you have access to when you're in Avondale or when you're downtown. The North Side, other parts of the West Side, the East Side don't have the access to public art that they should. Mm-hmm. And so a huge part of my job that I see as far as art in public places is to make sure that there's equality in terms of everyone having access to the arts. And that's one reason that Public Art Week is important, because it makes people more aware of this as a component of our community and as a part of our society in general. And it really, you know, calls out, what do you believe adds to your communities aesthetically as well as culturally?
It's 549-2937 as we talk about Public Art Week. Shawana Brooks with the Public Library. The city is right there outside your doors in Heming Park, going to have a bit of a shindig this week to celebrate public art. What's happening?
Yeah, we're really excited. We're in partnership with a lot of different cultural stakeholders here in arts and culture communities. So the Jacksonville Public Library is also partnering with the Museum of Contemporary Arts, the Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens, and Heming Park has been the prior galvanizer of all this intentionality in making sure that downtown is an important focus around public art. And as you said before, working for the Jacksonville Public Library, we do work for the city of Jacksonville, so we are public art just by our nature. So a lot of times people forget to come inside our different doors and that there are projects that have been commissioned by arts in public places, and also different things that, as they were built out, are in the city's purview of the collection. So you have to come into public libraries to also see public art. And as being a curator of one of the main public art galleries here in the city of Jacksonville, we make sure that when we do our art exhibitions across the board, those are centric to the city issues and bringing people in to expand their awareness around resources. Public art is great because it's outside and it's inside a lot of times, and you can find that divide, but it just gets you talking. And that's what we want. We want art that creates moments, that creates a little bit of a reflection, but that also sometimes pushes connection and that cultural divide that we're all looking for across communities.
And one thing that got people talking over the last week were these Harriet Tubman stickers that were popping up around downtown on manhole covers, other places. There's a controversy over the Trump administration putting on pause the Obama administration's intention to replace Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill with the face of Harriet Tubman. Andrew Jackson, after whom Jacksonville, Florida is named, of course, was a slave owner. He participated in the Native American removal and genocide, a very controversial historical figure. Harriet Tubman, of course, was the famed abolitionist. So Hope McMath, the city has issued cease and desist letters over these stickers, which are a form of public art. What's going on with this?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think the stickers give us another aspect of public art. When we talk about who really sanctions, supports, funds, gives space to public art, we know government does that. We know private entities and corporations do that. Places like the library, like Shawana mentioned. And then at times, individual artists are known to step forward, especially in the realm of social justice, to create public art projects that sometimes are not officially sanctioned. It's not the first time this has happened in our community. It certainly happens across the country and really across the world.
Controversy over public art. Movements or graffiti art or whatever you want to call it.
I mean, street art, of course, and the roots, to me, it's one of the most exciting sort of energetic sides of public art, is rarely sanctioned by the state. And so I think these stickers that are popping up around town sort of fall within that lineage of artists going to make statements about social issues using art and doing it in a very public way. Sometimes it's visual, sometimes it's performing, but the idea is that it's on the street where it meets people where they're at.
And Bill Delaney on the line from our partner, the Jackson Mag. You know, a few years ago, the artist Chip Southworth was putting up art around town without any official approval. He was known as Keith Haring's ghost. And he was cited. He was the city was going to pursue charges essentially against him. And he was able to successfully change city ordinance around public art, thanks to what his sort of street art activism. At the same time, in recent years, the organization Art Republic has put up huge, large scale murals on buildings all over town, adding to the public art scene. And at the Jackson Mag, you've been writing about other local heroes you think would be good for celebrating in terms of public art displays. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, the Harriet Tubman stickering is a really great parallel to the Keith Haring Ghost project that Chip Southworth put on. You know, what he was trying to do at that time was really advance the human rights ordinance to add LGBT protections. And that was something that the city was just, you know, not taking a stand on. They were trying to avoid. And so he went out, he painted electrical boxes primarily, and it really forced the city to start talking about those things. And it also, as you said, forced the city to reconsider, you know, the ordinances that they had against public art. Yeah, and right now what we're seeing, you know, it's stickers of Harriet Tubman going over Andrew Jackson. It's, you know, I think that the city right now is seen as it hasn't fully, embraced the issues that are being confronted there as far as social justice. You know, they recently decided not to put up a lynching memorial in Hemming Park. But yeah, I think it's all
and that would
that
have been a piece
lineage.
Of public art next to the statue of the Confederate soldier.
Right, that would have been public art that was officially sanctioned, and the city decided not to do it. So this is, you know, kind of, you know, movement saying, well, if the city's not going to do it, maybe it's time for the local artists to shake things up a little bit and force people to talk about these issues.
And you write about this at the Jackson Mag, as people are putting pictures of Harriet Tubman over pictures of Andrew Jackson around town. You have some other suggestions about who you think the city and local artists should be celebrating in terms of local connections to this community. Everyone from James Weldon Johnson to Harriet Beecher Stowe to Eartha White and A. Philip Randolph. Mm-hmm. You'd like to see more public art celebrating those historical figures, correct?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, if you're going to be tackling local issues in art, it would be, you know, it definitely wouldn't hurt to have some local figures behind you. So I made just some suggestions of some of the local people that we haven't done a great job of celebrating, or at least not to the extent of their importance.
One thing that I'm inspired to speak about, listening to Bill, and I loved Bill's article, I thought it was just terrific, is the Hope and History mural out east in Jacksonville.
Yes.
That commemorates Rodney Hurst and Axe Handle Saturday. It's really one of the first major public art projects in the city to do exactly the kind of thing that I think Bill is speaking to. Mm-hmm. The other thing I loved about that project is it was more than a mural on the wall. The mural was actually the culminating act of a year-long deep dive for a group of artists and students and civil rights leaders to learn together, to share power together, to make art together. And so the mural ended up something much larger than just the visual work of art that it is.
Shawana.
Yeah, and to Hope and Bill's point, what I love listening to Bill and now to Hope is that what they're giving is that perspective of process and also the history behind how some of these things happened. We talked about how in the beginning, those issues weren't on this side, but as they have progressed, now we have caught up. And as we're learning about all of these figures, to toot my own institution's horn, a lot of that information is housed through the Jacksonville Public Library. You can learn about historical figures that were very much important to Jacksonville. You can also see the civil rights timeline and that information that was cultivated by the city that exists on that site. And also we're seeing artists come into the fold not only to show history, but contemporary figures. If you go onto the east side now, there's a beautiful mural that's dedicated to astronaut Starbright, who is Taylor Richardson, who has done phenomenal work with her advocacy around STEAM and STEM projects. And that was by artist Roosevelt Watson III, who's a local artist here in our community. So people are pushing their ways forward with putting public art out there and having people talk about why these figures are important.
Well, whereas I absolutely appreciated Bill's article, I would probably be more inspired if a number of these stories of people from our local history were also taught in schools. That's where I would be most inspired. But my second point is the fact that everything can't be crammed into Hemming Park. You know, we need to understand that aesthetically, it doesn't work. There's no place for it to go. And we need to start moving outside of downtown and start incorporating other communities into the arts conversation. So much of the time we get upset when, well, it's not going downtown, so then it doesn't matter.
Right.
And it's not true. You know, also we have to keep in mind, we were just having this conversation before we went on air about the fact that sometimes you have to get private donors. I think the fact that you are waiting and hoping and, you know, sitting in prayer position, hoping that the government is going to be progressive on something that it hasn't been progressive on, especially when they still have Andrew Jackson as the town mascot, I think it's probably a futile, you know, we're sitting around wishing for something that more than likely won't take
place.
Yeah,
you couldn't devise more two polar opposite figures from history than Andrew Jackson and Harriet Tubman. They represent the divide in this country today. And so putting Harriet Tubman stickers around town is a political act. It's just the latest example of art making a political statement. And I'm thinking of just two recent examples that have gained attention around the world. One that comes to mind is the Fearless Girl sculpture in mm-hmm. front of the Bulls of Wall Street mm-hmm. that went up in 2017. And it was commissioned to advertise for an index fund that is made up of gender diverse companies. It's about the power of women in leadership. And so there were complaints about Fearless Girl came up after she was put up in Wall Street in lower Manhattan. And so even that is controversial. There's another famous sculpture showing politicians standing around debating whether climate change is real. Sculptures of the heads of a bunch of guys while the water is coming up around them.
Right. They look like they're submerged in water.
They look like they're slowly being submerged in water. That's another powerful example of public art that's designed to foster and bring about change about an important issue.
It's when it challenges the ideas that we've had about our culture for a long time. The Fearless Girl, for example, challenges, you know, male ideas about themselves. You know, the Bull on Wall Street is a very masculine sculpture. And then you have this little girl, which totally changes the
dynamic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so in that way, public art is more than a beautiful way of improving a public space. It's designed to foster social change.
Well, and it's both. I mean, mm-hmm. not every work of art is going to create social change, right? I think in most communities that have really rich public art initiatives, it's a combination of beauty, of placemaking, and of making statements around social need and social aspiration.
And Bill Delaney, as you write in the Jackson, putting up more public art honoring the city's leading historical figures would go a long way toward educating the public about these towering figures like A. Philip Randolph and James Weldon Johnson and Eartha White. You know, there's a street named after A. Philip Randolph. Mm-hmm. He led the March on Washington, where Dr. King famously spoke. There's a park named after him. There are some efforts to create a memorial to James Weldon Johnson mm-hmm. in the La Villa district of town. So there are some things, but what would you like to see? What would be a better tribute or even a more complete one?
Well, I think the idea of starting to teach these people in schools is, you know, a great end result. We definitely, you know, most of these figures are not people that get taught in schools. But I think that, you know, when we're talking about creating public art, and especially if we're going to be talking about public art that tries to say something about the city, which we do periodically, especially with, you know, like the murals downtown, we're trying to present the city as, you know, as a, you know, a hip, refreshing place. I think that we really need to also include people from our history that got us to where we are now. Mm-hmm. You know,
absolutely.
And especially if we're, you know, we have this concern that, you know, there's a couple of Confederate monuments around mm-hmm. and, you know, the Andrew Jackson, the statue that, you know, is increasingly seen as a controversial figure, you know, some people don't like. But what if we had, you know, some of the other people who really had an impact locally? You know, I think that would, you know, it would be a conversation starter, you know, get people who walk by it thinking about them. And what they did, why they are important, why the city sees them as important.
I remember a few years ago, activists put a Native American headdress on top
yes.
of the Andrew Jackson statue as a way to
yes.
protest honoring Andrew Jackson rather than...
Yeah, they sure did.
Yeah, rather than looking at him through the full lens of history. So that was a sort of a form of street art protest.
Yeah.
I guess you could say.
It absolutely
was. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've always thought that one way to, instead of using the money to remove these statues, is give artists the opportunity to re-envision them. Give artists the opportunity to go, you know, I don't know, repaint Andrew Jackson, add something different. I actually was speaking to somebody recently about some of the Confederate statues, and they were saying a lot of the time what's on these statues are plaques that talk about the history of the Confederacy. And what if we removed those plaques and had other plaques or other information telling people about the other contributions and other important people from that time period instead of focusing on the Confederacy? Because we're going to have to find a solution in terms of either repurposing these statues, because this is, I mean, I know a lot of people would disagree, but this is also valuable artwork from another part of our history. We have to acknowledge it. I'm not saying we have to honor it, but we do still have to acknowledge these parts of our history, or we are doomed to forget.
Let's go to a few calls. Linda in St. Mary's, Georgia. Go ahead, Linda.
There are a couple of cities in Europe that are just phenomenal with art and Prague and Czech Republic, but one of them is the sister city of Jacksonville is not France, and they have art everywhere. You turn around a corner and look up on a building, and you'll find this unexpected treasure of art, and it may be a walrus climbing the side of a wall, or I mean, it's very whimsical. It doesn't have to be all serious statuary and things like that. Businesses get involved, people get involved, museums get involved, and it's just it's a wonderful and beautiful place to visit because it's unexpected delight almost every part of the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that, Linda. That's absolutely right. Most cities in Europe, that's what you'll find. Bill at the beaches. Hi, Bill.
Yes. My original comment was going to be that art is great. It's wonderful. Maybe it's a public service thing. I hold to that, really. And for one person, it's great. For another person, it's not. It's a political statement, as you said. But the other thing is that it can morph very quickly into something like graffiti. And New York had a big-time problem with graffiti. And some people started to make it art, but essentially it was graffiti. And it really impacted people's lives and impacted property values. It changed the way people interacted with other people. And I think that you really... when you get into a position where you want to put art out in the public, I think it's probably more important for people, if they want art, to go buy art, to put it on their own building if they want, or on their own property. I don't know that half a dozen people who are making all the decisions about what art should be the final arbiter.
Okay,
and
yeah.
I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, let's talk about graffiti for a minute, because as Bill pointed out, say you lived through the 70s in New York, there was this incredible pushback to all the graffiti that, as he correctly pointed out, did affect the look of neighborhoods, property values, and that instituted a push toward more regulation of this kind of street art. And so the push and pull between allowing public art and regulating public art, that is what he's getting at.
Yeah, I love this caller's point. I mean, I think that he is, again, talking about decades ago. Now that we have caught up past that, that same art that was looked at as destroying and bringing down property values is now what you look for before you move into a new neighborhood. Even around our own neighborhoods, that we have seen that different private initiatives have happened where art has been regulated. And now, again, we're calling those things murals instead of calling them graffiti. Is it the style of the artist in which they have taken that then makes it look as something that's a little bit less appropriate to be in a neighborhood setting? That's the discussion. That becomes the conversation. And different art around different neighborhoods looks to be a little bit more flirty or beautiful, and other things can be a little bit more gritty. But that helps to also communicate what those neighborhood needs are a lot of times to outside people. And that's what those artists were doing at those times. And thankfully, people did hear and came into them and then also granted them perspective. But what we can't happen is artists going through that, making those cities or those areas or those communities hot, and then coming into them and then pushing those same people out when they're trying to basically put a problem on point.
Bill Delaney, you write about public spaces at the Jackson, and the sister site Modern Cities writes a lot about urbanism, improving public spaces. In your research and your colleagues' research, how does public art improve public spaces? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of studies that show that there's an economic value to public art, both in terms of tourism, but also in terms of your kind of placemaking, that when you install public art, that the businesses around it see a benefit. But even beyond the economics, I mean, there's a huge quality of life benefit to just being around art. You know, I don't know that there's ever been a civilization in history that, you know, that didn't have a big focus on public art and, you know, creating monuments and art dedicated to, you know, to their values and their people.
Here's an email from a listener. K Can anyone with a cause put stickers all over the city as a form of public art? You can't say that only the causes you agree with can do this. There should be the same rules for everyone. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about these Harriet Tubman stickers. The city has issued a cease and desist. Can you tell me a little more about that, Hope?
Sure. So the city has issued a cease and desist because it is art that was not sanctioned, and because these stickers were specifically being put on what is considered public property, which are the manhole covers that have the city seal.
And why manhole covers? Because of the city, the seal of the city of Jacksonville is on them?
Right. So some of the older manhole covers have the city seal, and the top half of the city seal shows Andrew Jackson on horseback. And so clearly, if an artist is wanting to make this statement about Harriet Tubman being put over, her reputation sort of being put over his, I don't know. I mean, manhole covers are pretty accessible to get to. So, these aren't sanctioned. And so anybody else who is going to go out and do this needs to understand what they would do is not sanctioned. But it is an act of protest. And whether people like it or not, protest is often disruptive, not always meant to be convenient. And fairly often, at least stretches the rules, if not fully breaking those rules.
Right.
So the cease and desist order specifically states that there are not to be any more put out. And those that were put out are to be removed.
Have they been removed?
No.
They're still there. Okay. So if you walk around downtown or I guess Riverside, you'll see these stickers.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, let's talk about the fact too, Tracy, that what goes on the $20 bill or any currency, that's also a form of art. Andrew Jackson's face is on the 20. The Obama administration put into motion plans to phase out Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill and put on Harriet Tubman. And just the other day, an image was released to news outlets showing what the $20 bill would look like if Harriet Tubman were on it, her portrait. And so the Trump administration and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin have slow rolled these plans to phase out Andrew Jackson on the 20 and put on Harriet Tubman, and have drawn criticism for that because they gave, frankly, not a very believable reason as to why they said technical delays were delaying this. But it's a political divide. It's reflective of the political divide in this country.
Absolutely. It won't happen during the time of this administration at all. I don't think that we need to look forward to a slow roll or any other type of roll. It's totally stopped. I think I appreciate Harriet Tubman and what she contributed to history. I don't necessarily think the $20 bill is where I would like to see her. But I think to honor what she's done, it's one of the ways that we can make sure that people recognize her as someone who has contributed to this, not just this country, but this world in a way that no one else has.
Wayne emails the show. Few may remember, but upstairs at the Jacksonville Landing, there was a Founders Hall. There were large medallions all along the hall with plaques on the pillars telling the story of people from the early years of Jacksonville. Now that history is history. And he's talking about the demolition, the planned demolition of the Jacksonville Landing.
Yeah.
That public art will be demolished. Here is an email from Sandra. I love public art. Does the city have a directory of public art? It would be wonderful having sort of a passport to locate these statues, murals, and plaques to learn more about their significance.
Art in Public Places actually does have a pamphlet that lays out the pieces of artwork that are downtown and beyond. So through the Cultural Council, you could probably acquire in their offices that pamphlet. It's probably not as up to date as it should be.
But culturalcouncil.org for more about that.
I would say yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so, Shawana, let's close with you. People can come out to Hemming Park this week for more about public art in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I believe today is going to be the installation of the sculptures of the UNF students. And that was a collaboration through Hemming Park and the Museum of Contemporary Arts in the University of North Florida. So that's going to be exciting. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly the time. I want to say like 11 o'clock, but it's always a really good time around that time to come to downtown to see everything that's going on. And there's going to be individual art projects that are going to be going on through a lot of the art institutions. So the Jacksonville Public Library will be representing on Tuesday and Thursday. We're going to ask you for your ideas and also things that you love about Jacksonville to go on to new pieces that we're introducing into a public art project that was done a few years ago to really talk about, you know, where the heart of Jacksonville and where you are the eye of Jacksonville. So your ideas need to be represented, as well as there'll be public art tours, and my own institution will be servicing one that Thursday evening. You can come into the Jacksonville Public Library. I will be there representing and speaking a little bit about our current exhibition, which is called Reclaimed: Life Beyond the Landfill, that talks about recycling, which a lot of people view as a city issue, but well-informed people and critical thinkers will know that that is actually contracted through the city of Jacksonville. So we're hoping to expand
there's
awareness
a lot happening.
And
okay.
information.
And more at thejacksonmag.com as well, one of our media partners. So thank you, Bill Delaney on the line. He's with the Jackson. Hope McMath, Yellow House, Shawana Brooks with the Main Library, and Tracy Thornton, Art in Public Places. Thank you for being with us today, all four of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, Cole Pepper on a dramatic finish at the U.S. Open. But up next, June is Pride Month. We'll tell you about a local staging of the Coming Out Monologues. We'll be right back.
WGCT's podcast, What It's Like, tells the stories of local people.
I delivered a stillborn baby. The doctors always let you hold them, let you see them, and then they take them away and you never see them again.
Did you feel illegal?
You know, this word is tossed around so loosely.
I did. I kind of felt shame sometimes.
Take a listen to What It's Like wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. June is Pride Month, a great time for a local staging of the Coming Out Monologues. Creator, producer Tina Von Wardle and cast member Andres Bravo are here to tell us about this weekend's special shows here in our building. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right. So let's begin with you, Tina. These shows are Friday and Saturday, WJCT. Proceeds benefit Jasmine and P-Flag of Jax. Since its beginning, Coming Out Monologues has raised $70,000 for these two groups. So it's had a really good run in the city, really successful.
Yeah, we think so. We think at this point we've become somewhat counted on by the community, and folks just set the time aside in June to come to the show. And obviously, over the last 8 years of doing this, I'm constantly reflecting on the purpose that we serve in the community. And lately, I've landed on this story kinship, and I think it's this relationship that we're creating with audience members, because it's the one time of year where we provide this opportunity for them to have some sharedness between other folks that are different from them, but also mm-hmm. really appreciate the differences between us that set us apart.
These are people that live in this community just telling their true stories.
Yes,
on stage.
Exactly. Yes.
And that's powerful, just sharing your story.
It's incredibly powerful. And they're not only stories of coming out and what that felt like and what the experience looked like, but it's also experiences of falling in love or experiencing heartbreak, having the first child, et cetera.
Andres Bravo, you're one of the performers at this year's Coming Out Monologues.
Yes, I am. I'm so excited.
First time?
Yes, it's the first time.
How did you get involved with this?
Well, I actually was lucky enough to see the 2018 show, and it was the year where there were three trans men who gave their stories out. And as a transgender man myself, I felt incredibly surprised and just honored to see these stories. And it reminded me that, wow, what I've gone through is worth sharing and it can actually help someone, because I was incredibly touched by the story. And I just knew then, like, I have to volunteer for this next year. I just knew.
Can you read a little excerpt of your monologue?
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
My mom hated how I always wore shorts and baggy shirts. She would yell, "You look like a boy." I didn't care. Even then, I felt relief at the thought of someone thinking I was a boy. My best friends were boys. I played too rough and scared all the girls. And when you just wanted me to hear how bad your day was, I was always ready to give unsolicited advice. I didn't dream of getting married in a wedding dress either. My dream was to grow with broad shoulders, strong arms, a six-pack, to be an artist, to ride motorcycles, to wear a nice suit to formal events. I was 13 when I found Logo, the gay channel. I delighted in watching the station in secret. I saw a show on transgender people and something clicked. I saw guys just like me, born with my parts, with male names, who were prescribed testosterone to help them look and feel more masculine. Most of them were very butch and had an abrasive, angry energy, but one of the trans guys spoke with kindness, rode a motorcycle, practiced massage therapy, and wore a nice suit. I felt kinship. We had the same kind of masculine energy. I like some feminine things too, like massage therapy and painting, but I was still a guy. I wrote in my journal, "I'm a boy, no matter what anybody says, and I'm going to be a man. If I still feel this way when I move out, I'm going to transition."
Thanks for reading that. Okay, so Andre's story, Tina, is like a lot of other stories that people share. It tells about their childhood. It tells about the struggle involved behind coming out. And it helps straight people who come to these shows have a better understanding.
Yeah, I think so. And ideally, that leads to social change at the individual level. Hearts and minds, that's our goal.
Absolutely.
And do you feel it's accomplishing that?
I think so. And that's just based on the sheer feedback we get from audience members who come up to us after each and every show, or feedback that we get on Facebook.
And all of the profits from the monologues benefit Jasmine and PFLAG. And these are organizations that help kids and families. Can you share a little bit about how the money is used?
Yes, absolutely. The only money that we make from the show is through ticket sales or donations that people like to make. And we turn all of that over to Jasmine and PFLAG, who are serving primarily the youth in our community through counseling, medical services, support groups, et cetera.
A lot of kids don't have family support and they can be kicked out of their homes, ostracized. Mm-hmm. It can be tough for LGBT kids.
Absolutely. That's why we're so grateful for Jasmine and everything they do. PFLAG, they're amazing organizations.
Did your family support you?
It was kind of an interesting mix of both. I feel like outwardly there was some support, but at the same time, I feel like my parents and I aren't quite at an understanding. But luckily, I do have an amazing group of friends and family over here in Jacksonville who do support me, and I'm so grateful for them.
Well, it's the 8th annual Coming Out Monologues. It's Friday and Saturday at WJCT. You can get your tickets now or at the door, which so many people in this city like to do. But come on out. Three shows this weekend and a unique theatrical experience in our own soundstage. So thank you both so much for being here. Tina Von Wertel and cast member Andres Brava. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Have a great show. Okay, now let's get back to vertigo. Vertigo can be a very scary thing when it happens to you, and it's more common than you think. We are hosting a seminar Wednesday here at lunchtime on vertigo, and it's free. I spoke about it with Dr. Douglas Green of Jacksonville's Hearing and Balance Institute. Take a listen. Dr. Green, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about vertigo. People have a lot of questions. For example, what's the difference between vertigo and dizziness?
Vertigo comes from the Latin root word that means to spin. So typically when we say vertigo, as clinicians, we're thinking about someone that has a spinning sensation. Although some patients and even clinicians will oftentimes confuse the two, They might say I'm dizzy when they're having a spinning sensation, or occasionally the other way around. So, but typically vertigo we think of as a spinning sensation.
And what causes vertigo?
Vertigo can be caused by a problem within the inner ear, which is the most common location, but occasionally it'll be caused by a problem within the central nervous system, within the brain itself. So a lot of the investigations that we do are trying to discern, is this really an inner ear problem, or is this a problem within the brain itself, within the central nervous system?
And should people be concerned if they're experiencing vertigo symptoms? How serious is it?
Well, it can be serious, certainly. So if someone is having vertigo, I would certainly encourage an evaluation initially, a lot of times it'll be through their primary care doctor. But if it's a persistent problem, it's very important to be seen by someone that has expertise in diagnosing the causes of vertigo.
And how is it treated?
It's treated most commonly initially with what we call a vestibular suppressant. That would be something that suppresses the signals from the inner ear, such as meclizine or sometimes diazepam. If it continues to be an ongoing problem, there are other forms of treatment that can be used, some preventative treatments as opposed to medications that are used when the episodes occur.
It can be scary to have this happen, can't it? It's frightening.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Very frightening. It can really, really throw people for a loop, because it seems like all of a sudden, especially with the vertigo, the world is spinning around. You can't tell which way is up, which way is down. And sometimes there's nausea and vomiting associated with it. It can be very, very significant.
So definitely have it checked out if you're experiencing these symptoms.
And absolutely.
Dr. Douglas Green with the Jacksonville Hearing and Balance Institute, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Again, that is Identifying and Treating Vertigo. This is a free event, and it's coming up this Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. here at WJCT. You can register now. For more, visit wjct.org/events. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and in a moment, Cole Pepper with all the weekend sports news and notes, including a dramatic finish at golf's U.S. Open. That's coming up in just a few moments. Keep listening. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
More of your favorite PBS shows than ever before.
This is the future!
With PBS Passport, a member benefit that lets you binge many of the latest shows and catch up on your favorites.
We really are living in the modern world.
Anytime you want.
Wow, how about that?
Anywhere you are.
There's literally nothing like this in the world.
Learn more at wjct.org/passport.
On the next Fresh Air, the unique medical needs of older adults. Terry talks with geriatrician Louise Aronson, author of the new book Elderhood, about what it means to live longer and to be on more medications. Aronson describes the challenges of helping elders in her own family and flaws in the current healthcare system. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
In the Pacific Northwest, there's growing concern over the number of deaths in county jails. Many of those deaths are from suicide.
We have people who are very sick in our facilities and we don't know how to deal with them. And because we don't know how to deal with them, they're dying.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, trying to prevent suicide behind bars this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
In May 2020, the Florida Historical Society will be hosting a Caribbean conference cruise to San Juan, Puerto Rico, and other islands with historical connections to Florida. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss those connections, including Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon, astronaut John Glenn, and the Seminole. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Ned, Keith, Zach, and Eugene are old friends who built a following by screwing things up until they get it right.
I don't think I've cut my nails in 20 years.
What?
Yeah.
Nail extensions, eating the whole Taco Bell menu, even labor pain. They'll try just about anything on their award-winning YouTube channel. We'll meet the Try Guys next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it was a dramatic finish at golf's U.S. Open.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
It's Monday, which means Cole Pepper is here to tell us more about all the sports news from the weekend. He's on the line. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, there were so many storylines coming into the final round of the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach yesterday. We wondered, could Brooks Koepka become just the second player ever to win three straight U.S. Opens? He was in contention going into the final round. Could Rory McIlroy become the first player to win the Players and the U.S. Open in the same year? And could Gary Woodland win his first major? He began the day with the lead, and it turns out he would finish the day with the lead, including draining a 30-foot putt on the 18th hole. He only needed a 3-putt to win there, but why not do it in style? It's Woodland's first major championship and the first time in his career that he's won a tournament when he's led after 54 holes. So a big day for him. By the way, Melissa, he's also a proud Kansas Jayhawk, so rock chalk,
nice. Okay, let's talk about the U.S. Women's National Team as well.
Yeah, and this is sort of the question. After you put on one of the all-time great performances in the history of the sport, how do you follow it up? The U.S. beat Thailand 13-0 in record fashion to open the World Cup and then had to follow their own act. They beat Chile 3-0 in the group stage. Still a very lopsided win, but boy, 13-0 is something. The U.S. now has already qualified for the knockout round, and they can win the group with a win or draw against Sweden on Thursday. Watching how the tournament is playing out, the United States came into the tournament as one of the favorites to win. And while Thailand is not necessarily a top-tier team, the way that they have played, the depth that they have shown, the depth of talent the U.S. has, it's hard to imagine somebody really pushing the United States. There are some teams that maybe could do so, including the host country, France, Germany. Canada's had a good run, but right now the United States looks like they're steamrolling toward another Women's World Cup championship.
In soccer, 13-0? 13 goals? That's almost unheard of in soccer, isn't it?
It is unheard of in the history of World Cup soccer. It's the highest scoring match. It's the most lopsided match and the biggest shutout, the clean sheet victory ever in the Women's World Cup. And while if you look at the talent and the resources that are put towards women's soccer globally, it pales in comparison to what the men have in just about every country. It's still the World Cup. I mean, these are the elite teams in the country, in the world, from their countries. And the U.S. just made Thailand look like, not even the JV squad, made them look like the eighth grade team playing the varsity. It was something to see. I think it's the most dominating performance at a top-level event I've ever seen in any sport.
Pretty amazing. Okay, last but not least, let's talk about Florida State and the College World Series. They're on a roll, too.
Yeah, what a great story this would be. Again, we talked about this last week. Mike Martin, the longtime head coach of the Seminoles, the all-time winningest coach in the history of NCAA athletics in any sport, will retire at the end of the year, and Florida State just keeps pushing back his retirement party. What a game Saturday night in Omaha from the Seminoles. FSU knocked off Arkansas 1-0 to move on to the winner's bracket of the College World Series. J.C. Flowers, the Trinity Christian product, scored the only run of the game in the ninth. Then he sprinted down to the bullpen down the right field line, got loose, came in, and pitched the final three outs for the save. And the win keeps the dream alive of ending Mike Martin's career with his first College World Series championship. It's the only thing he's lacking from his illustrious career. Next up, the Noles will face Michigan tonight at 7 in the double elimination tournament. So even if the Noles were to lose to Michigan, they're still alive. But if they were to beat the Wolverines, not only would it advance them in great shape on that side of the bracket, but just the fact that these two teams are playing one another, these are two of the last four teams that qualified for the tournament. So both of these teams were facing long odds to get to where they are right now. I think Florida State has a great chance. They saved their top pitcher for game two. He'll go tonight. And what a story for Mike Martin after 40 years as the head coach of the Seminoles to be where he is right now in his final season is really getting a lot of attention.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of that sentimental feeling I think so many fans have. They just want to see that capstone to a great career, I guess.
Yeah, and a guy who has always been a class act, always treats people so well, so gracious. I spoke to him when he came to town to play JU, and again, it would wind up being rained out. And just having the conversation with a guy who has such great perspective and history in the game is a lot of fun. But the way that he treats people earns him friends everywhere. So, dare I say it, there are either even the Gator fans and Clemson fans and Georgia Bulldog fans who are rooting for Mike Martin now in the College World Series.
Always good to have you on the show. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Watch him every night at Channel 4, our news partner, the local station. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, we speak with Roy Miller of Florida's Children's Campaign. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.